Las Vegas Weekly's Radio Mag on KUNV. I'm Sarah Felberg, editor of Las Vegas Weekly. And on tonight's show, we are talking on the Strip and into downtown. First up, Steve Freese is here to tell me about the Jockey Club, an aging Strip property among giants in the center of the action. Later on, Kristen Peterson will join us to talk about First Friday Without Whirligig this past week and what it means for the local arts festival. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
So, the Jockey Club. I know a lot of people might not be that familiar with this property. Tell me a little bit about when it was built and what its original intent was.
Well, the Jockey Club was one of the first condo developments in Las Vegas, in Nevada. It was the third condo development in Nevada. One of the first ones was over like Regency Towers, I think. And so this was the first one on the Strip. And the idea behind it, when it was conceived in, say, 1972, they started selling it. It was constructed and finished around 1974. The idea was that there were all these employees who maybe would want to live on the Strip near their jobs, which, you know, sounds very familiar, considering that is exactly the way, well, maybe that's sort of what the folks at the City Center had planned too. I mean, they didn't necessarily think that the workers were going to live in the condos at City Center, but they did think maybe some of the executives and,
sure,
you know, the young urban people without children might want to live there. And then, as now, it was very quickly discovered that there really aren't a lot of people who want to live on the Strip in Vegas.
Sure. And understandably so. And I mean, when the Jockey Club was built in the mid-1970s, mm-hmm, the Strip was a really different place. If you drive down the Strip right now, you can barely see the property.
Right.
But at the time, it actually had a pretty primo address.
Yeah, it was 3700 South Las Vegas. It still is 3700 South Las Vegas Boulevard, which means, you know, I mean, that means it was one of the block. It was the block. And, you know, it's funny because not only has it changed a lot in this, say, 30 years, but it's changed dramatically just in the last 5 or 6
right,
years. There was a picture on the front page of the Las Vegas Sun right after Terry Lanney, the former CEO of MGM Mirage, had died. It was above his obituary about a month and a half, 2 months ago. And what you see is Terry Lanney standing on one of those balconies at the Bellagio with the southern view of the Strip behind him. And all you see is a Jockey Club and then some cranes that will someday build everything else that's around it.
Sure.
But that picture was only taken 5 or 6 years ago.
Wow. It's amazing how quickly things have changed.
Well, I mean, that's why Vegas has been so interesting to cover for the last decade or so. And maybe one of the reasons why it's going to be a little less interesting to cover in the next decade is because there really aren't going to be that dramatic a change to the skyline. But, you know, the Jockey Club was there. And the other thing that's important about it is, so they realized very quickly that the condo buyers just wanted to turn it, either flip it for, mm-hmm, a profit or turn it into some sort of a rental pool so that the Jockey Club people could rent it out and they could make money off of an investment while they waited for perhaps it to increase in value. But it kind of worked. But then at some point they decided to try this newfangled idea of the timeshare. And it was,
right,
the first timeshare. Nowadays, people think of timeshares, they think of those annoying people who are always approaching them in the hotels, trying to get them to come to seminars and giving them, like, you know, free tickets to shows nobody wants to see. And but back then it was a very new idea back in the 70s, this idea of buying just a week.
Sure.
And then as that industry changed, it became a week that perhaps you could exchange for another week somewhere else or another time of day, time of year, something like that. But that was sort of where it went. It became a timeshare. The point of that is that if there are 250 units in the place,
mm-hmm,
they're about, give or take, I think that's about it, there are now 14,000 different owners.
Wow.
And what that means is,
who each own a week, essentially.
Yeah. Everybody owns about a week. Some own more than that. But that's a lot of different people. And every single one would have to agree for the place to ever get bought out and knocked down. And I thought it was really interesting when I called Alan Feldman from MGM Resorts, who was for a long time Steve Wynn's spokesman.
Sure.
When Steve Wynn built the Bellagio, which is right next door, and replaced the dunes. What he mentioned was that they didn't even bother to try to buy the place.
Right.
It wouldn't be worth it. How could you do it? And what's interesting to me about that is that's the future of the Strip. The future of the Strip is all of these condo properties that 30, 40, 50 years ago. It's hard to imagine now that someday they may want to redevelop the Vidalia.
Sure.
But someday they might, because 30 years ago, the Polo Towers was like really cheechy.
Right.
And, you know, look at it now.
Everything gets dated.
It gets dated very quickly. And, I mean, these buildings that have been built now in City Center and some of these other places are clearly built to last a lot longer.
Sure.
But that's not the appetite and the history of Las Vegas. The history of Las Vegas is constant reinvention.
Right.
Which sometimes Las Vegas gets a bad rap for, but there's a reason why Vegas does it. There's a reason why they're, as we speak, selling the urinals at the NASCAR Cafe at the Sahara, because it's time for that building to go.
And it's really interesting. You mentioned that, the kind of nature of reinvention of Las Vegas. And because of the situation with the timeshares and the 14,000 owners, the Jockey Club is really kind of an anomaly in that sense at the moment of an aging property right in the middle of everything on a prime piece of real estate that is still around.
Right.
Now, what about if I'm as a local and I'm not a timeshare owner there, if I want to go check out the Jockey Club, I have to admit I've never been inside.
Yeah.
Can you rent a room there?
Yeah, that's exactly how I did the piece. I went online. They rent out rooms. There is a portion of the units that are specifically like units that somebody who owns a share just hasn't used or won't use that year. There's I think she said it was 3 to 5% of the units of, you know, so they have a pool from which they can rent out the rooms as hotel rooms, and they're big. They're not very nice, but they're big.
Uh-huh.
And
spacious.
And they, so yes, you can either go online and book it, or you can call up and book it. And let me tell you, it's a deal. I mean, the night that I stayed there, it was I think $80 a night.
Uh-huh.
And in that same night, that was about at least $40 to $50 less than the hotels in the area.
Wow.
Even the Vidara, or obviously the Bellagio, and you're in this perfect location.
Yeah, you're really in the center of everything there.
But, you know, it's still the Jockey Club.
It is still the Jockey Club, but there's been a couple of interesting developments for the Jockey Club in the last 5 years. The main one of which is Cosmo and its relationship with Cosmo. And it does have a really sort of interesting intertwined relationship with the property.
It's really a weird one. I mean, I can't think of anything else quite like it. This old, old building that doesn't look very nice is attached by an elevator that is a little hard to find, that gets you into the casino at the Cosmo, and then all of a sudden you're in this whole other world. I mean, the only thing that I think is a little bit similar, and it's not the same, but there's, you know, the Four Seasons is part of the building that's Mandalay. That is the Mandalay Bay.
Mm-hmm.
And there's sort of this, again, sort of an unmarked magic door. Only in this case, it's an unmarked magic door that takes you into a much lusher, more beautiful place. In this case, there's a sort of quietly, there's this little elevator bank, and then you're in the Cosmo, and it's this dramatic step down in terms of decor. But the people from the Jockey Club are, in that case, getting a tremendous amount of new amenities.
Right.
They get to go over there, and they can gamble, which they couldn't do before, and they can use the restaurants, and they are allowed to use the pool.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I mean, they're not riffraff. They're, you know, they're normal people. It's
sure.
not like there's anything wrong with these people. In fact, what's interesting to me was that I kind of thought that the whole timeshare thing was something that old people did.
Uh-huh.
And it turned out that I was really surprised. So many of the other people who were staying there, and these are people who own, who have a week there,
right.
Were families and diverse families, all kinds of races and so on. And I thought that was kind of nice in a way that you know, it makes sense because, okay, you can go there. You have a large space. You have I think that the couches pull out and that kind of thing. And it's less expensive. It's the middle of the place. And then there's all these great amenities there.
And you also mentioned in your story that there are the Jockey Club does have some of its own amenities, too, which seem a little dated right now. But if you are staying with a big family, they might be appealing.
Yeah, actually, there's some kind of charming little ideas. They have, a lending library. You can get, borrow some movies or some board games. They have a pool there, the Jockey Club pool. And what's funny about it is I thought it was kind of an interesting artsy sort of thing when I saw it at first.
Uh-huh.
It's got a netting above it with these these strings of light. So
right.
It's sort of got this sort of California backyard, sort of the brothers and sisters kind of look thing going on. And then I find out that actually it's functional. When they were building the Cosmopolitan, they put up that netting so that like construction debris wouldn't fall into the pool and knock people who were like there sunbathing. And they left it there because now there are people who check in at the Cosmo who drop stuff off their balconies.
Sure.
So, you know, they kind of get the raw end of the deal, but they were there first and they, whatever it is. The thing that's interesting, they also have like a shuttle to the local supermarket because they have a full kitchen there
that
you can use. And they have movie nights, I think, once a week. And they have free popcorn. And, you know, there's some cute little things going on there. It's interesting. Yeah.
Now, do you think there are lessons that could have been learned from the Jockey Club before we got into this condo development phase? We've seen a number of condo towers going up all over the strip in the last 5 or 10 years that have had varying degrees of success, but most of them not a whole lot of success.
Right.
And it seems like we kind of had a model of this a long time ago.
Well, that's the thing that's fascinating to me. I don't know if there's any way that anybody who in the middle of that boom could have stopped themselves, looked at this crappy little box and said, oh, that's our future. Because you never think that, you know, what you're building is someday going to look dated or old. You think you're in the moment and you're trying to make money. But certainly, you know, there are many principles here that could have been learned from. One is that there is not a critical mass of people who actually want to live on the ship.
Sure.
There just isn't. And there was never any proof of it. The closest proof you had was Turnberry, and Turnberry was strategically not on the ship.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a bit off. And it was also high end. Secondly, is this question about redevelopment someday. And these companies that were building these things, particularly MGM Resorts, knew this. They had the Jockey Club stuck in the middle of their property for this very reason. They're the ones. And yet they're the ones that built the Signature Towers, and they're the ones that built these other things. The idea for them was they were building something that they wouldn't have to worry about later.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were building something. They could sell the units. They could use the capital to finance building these things. And that was sort of a trade that worked out for them. It worked out for them on Signature, less so in City Center. But, you know, I just don't see that they would have ever listened to that kind of warning. It seems so removed and far away. It's probably only in hindsight that you can see just how similar these things are.
Sure. And I think it'll be so interesting in, you know, 30 to 40 years from now to take a look back at the properties that we're talking about right now, the Vidaras, the Signatures, and to really say, you know, are these the current jockey clubs of the future, rather? And just kind of see how they're faring.
Well, it's such a physically, it's such a weird looking thing. And that's where this story came from in the first place. You look at this building just sitting there, you know, it looks older. It is what it is. And then it's just surrounded by just opulence. I mean, it's connected to the Cosmo. It's right next to the Bellagio. It's, you know, its view to the south is now ruined by City Center. And it's not ever going anywhere.
Right. So that was my kind of final question for you. We're running out of time, but what is the potential future for Jockey Club?
It's going to be there for as long. Years ago, a friend of mine used to say acrylic paint and cockroaches. That's what's going to last after the nuclear holocaust, and perhaps the Jockey Club too.
I kind of like that image, the Jockey Club standing tall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for joining me. It was a pleasure having you.
Thanks for having me.
And you can read more about Steve Freese's experience at the Jockey Club and about the historic property in this week's issue of Las Vegas Weekly. Welcome back to Las Vegas Weekly's Radio Mag on KUNV. I'm Sarah Felberg, editor of Las Vegas Weekly, and last Friday night we saw a slightly different incarnation of First Friday, the monthly arts festival downtown in the Arts District, and staff writer Kristen Peterson is here to tell us what the scene was like and to give us a little bit of the history of the event. Welcome, Kristen.
Thank you. I was down there Friday night, and it sort of looked like the old First Friday. There were obviously more people and a couple more businesses in the area, but the only thing that was different is they didn't have the big street festival.
So let's back up for
a
second. So the old First Friday, when did First Friday first get started?
Geez, I got it. It's going to turn 9 in October.
Okay.
I didn't know there was going to be math, but it was like 2002, 2003.
Yeah.
Maybe 2002, I guess. And that was when Cindy started it. She had been to something, because Wes from the Arts Factory originally had an annual arts festival called GAME that was in the Arts District. And then Cindy decided to do a monthly one based on something she had seen in, I believe, Oregon.
Very cool.
And so, yeah, she opened the Funk House, and the Arts Factory was also open. I think this was back when they were talking to each other. And so there were a few things happening, and it was like a kind of a laid-back art crawl, you know, very focused on exhibit openings and sales in the stores and a small crowd.
Sure. And now, I mean, in the time since then, the whole Arts District has changed.
Mm-hmm.
So how have we seen the whole neighborhood change?
Well, it's funny that we talk about how it's changed, because it changes, but it keeps going back. It keeps going back to where you sort of have the north and south, and you have something on Commerce Street, because there were a lot of stores like Got Clary Gallery was there, and Naomi Aaron had Dust Gallery on Main Street, and those are gone. But there is more activity, particularly with Brett Wesley there.
Sure.
And then across from the Arts Factory right on Charleston, there are a few more studios. And then I think it's called Gaia Flowers.
Uh-huh.
But so there's more activity in the area just on a day-to-day basis. But the festival got really big,
right,
is what happened. They started doing multiple stages with bands and the trolley service. And at one time, Wholesome Lofts had the galleries in there, so they're coming back and forth. And it just got pretty busy, and some people thought crazy. I mean, the kind of issue of the festival thing has come up a lot in the Arts District, because there are business owners who would like to be open, but they don't want a festival.
Right. So it kind of seems, I mean, my impressions, and I've been, I wasn't in Vegas when it first mm-hmm. opened, but in recent years when I've attended First Friday, it almost feels like there's two different crowds that are enjoying the event. And there are the people who are really spending their times in the galleries, going to the exhibits and maybe purchasing work.
Mm-hmm.
And the people who are kind of spending most of their time outside on the street, listening to the bands, maybe eating some food and maybe purchasing some small items from the people who set up booths outside. And that they kind of seem like two different crowds interacting at the same event, but they're almost attending two separate parts of it.
Yeah, there's not. I mean, so a lot, there is overlap.
Right.
There is overlap, but as far as you said, there are kind of two chunks of things happening. And then you have someone who kind of brisks through it all and then goes to Casa Don Juan and has a big dinner. They were packed Friday, too. And, you know, so they get a lot of business on First Friday. But, yeah, there are two crowds. And you'll see, you know, more of the collectors are in the Arts Factory looking at whatever's at Trifecta or CAC. The other thing is... What changed a little bit, there would have been even more of a separation, but a lot of gallery owners did not want the gallery openings to land on First Friday when
right.
there were swarms of people coming through. So they created Preview Thursday.
What's Preview Thursday?
That is First Friday without all the bing and bang and, you know, it's
sure.
it's just basically galleries that have stayed open, and restaurants, of course, the Bar and Bistro, that's right there. But a lot of the galleries, even Blackbird Studios is open, Brett Wesley is open, and people just come through. That's when they actually have the official exhibit openings.
Okay.
That's when they bring in the artist, and they have a little food and wine, and people look at art and
sure.
talk.
So it's a time to really sort of absorb the art.
Yeah.
And just really get to sink in with that.
Yeah, and you can, you know, it's still an event. You know, some people avoid events altogether, and if they want to see the art, they go and nobody's there. But yeah, it's still an event. But that sort of separated the big divide that was happening on First Friday.
Okay. And now there was an interesting news that came out of First Friday just about a month ago, I want to say, which involved Whirligig and Cindy's portion of the event.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened there?
Well, Cindy's put on this event, you know, since it started. You know, like I said, she basically started the monthly event, and she's had a lot of health problems, but has still consistently put it on. It's almost been a one-woman operation.
Wow.
But it's very costly, and the city sort of scaled back on its funding. And August and September are the slowest times for First Friday because
okay.
of the heat. I believe that's why it is, but those are usually the slow months. So Whirligig decided to scale back because it's really been having trouble funding the
sure.
event, because putting up the gates and closing the streets and getting the permits and vendors, it was becoming a headache. And so Cindy and the Whirligig board all decided to close it these 2 months, to close the street festival and just put it on hiatus. The problem came when they announced it, they didn't say, they basically said First Friday is canceled.
But First Friday has really taken on a meaning that goes beyond the street festival.
Yeah, and Whirligig does own, I believe, the Las Vegas First Friday name. I believe it owns that name, but it just said First Friday is going to go to 2 month hiatus. And there are a lot of businesses that really rely on this event, which brought up some issues because, you know, the businesses don't always participate in the festival. Like Cindy's not getting a collection hat and going around getting money from people. People are not contributing to that event. But then they feel like, well, we don't want to because we don't want a festival and our people are here to look at art. So that kind of just ignited some earlier dialogue, I should say animosity.
No, we were both down there last Friday, which was the first of the First Fridays, the next 2 months where they are on hiatus at Whirligig. And tell me, what were your impressions of the scene? I think people were kind of up in the air. There was some confusion still about whether it was even happening.
Yeah, I kept my ears open for people who would say, oh, this is a drag. You know, there's usually things going on all over, but I didn't sense that. By the time the event came around, I think from what I saw, and I was just one person walking around different areas, people kind of knew what was happening by that day. But yeah, there was a lot of confusion. Somebody at Blackbird or Studios brought up an interesting issue that there were people out there, and part of the reason she thought that some of them were out there after their announcement is because there was so much press.
Right.
You know, so all of a sudden everyone has First Friday in their minds because the news stations started covering First Friday now and the issues going on there. So she's more worried that next month will be problematic.
Oh, that's interesting.
Because they know 2 month hiatus, but there isn't going to be a lot of press saying, whoa, wait, it's not actually canceled. There's stuff happening.
Right. It was. I mean, everybody was talking about it in advance of the August First Friday event because there was so much confusion. And now that it seems like, oh, well, we've already done this once, there might not be as much press around it.
Yeah. And also there's a group now calling themselves First Friday South on 3rd and Imperial, further down from the Funk House and everything, that actually did have some barricades up and some porta potties out. And they were doing their thing down there by Theater 7.
Uh-huh.
And then... but yeah, I mean, it seemed by the time, 8 and 9 o'clock came around, people were in their groove and doing their thing. And, you know, stores had customers, people were looking at art. It was definitely slower.
Uh-huh.
You know, as much as they argue about the festival, obviously somebody likes it because they're getting thousands of people down there.
Right.
To during this sort of chaotic festival. You know.
And I thought it was interesting. One of the things I noticed, and they've probably been doing this for a little while, but because there was no festival, right on one of the corners where there's usually stages set up and food trucks out, which is where Cornerstone Gallery is, they had actually taken their backyard and Fuku Burger had pulled into the backyard.
I saw that.
And they were serving burgers out there. And Rhyme and Rhythm, a local hip-hop band, had set up back there too in the backyard, and they were playing a set. So some of the sort of festival ambiance had just kind of moved really barely off the street at all, just kind of the sidewalk's width was all that was separating from the street and its location last Friday. But it was interesting to see that kind of that atmosphere still happening right in the middle of everything.
Yeah, it was kind of a statement like, well, we still want this to happen. We don't have the permits and we don't have the streets closed. But I saw that truck and I thought it was kind of funny the way it was just sort of stealthily pulled in right there. And they're just carrying on as if nothing happened. They just moved it all into the sidewalk, which is what Cindy did back, I think, in 2009 when they didn't have the street festival.
Okay.
The only difference is she was open and there was still a lot happening on the sidewalk.
Now, you saw a number of the exhibits that are open right now during First Friday. Tell me about a couple that you think are worth people heading down and seeing, even if they didn't get down there last weekend.
Wow. There are so many. There's an interesting photo exhibit over at Brett Wesley. I would just say go down on a day when you know they're all going to be open. Check their hours.
That's an important
thing. Through everything. It's kind of fun. But there's that interesting exhibit at Trifecta Gallery on the Cirque posters.
Right. Tell me a little bit more about that.
Cirque, somebody associated with Cirque came up with an idea to have mainly street artists create posters for different shows, and they presented it to Cirque, and Cirque agreed to go along with this. And so it's been, I think this is its fourth city. It's an wow. international tour. Artists, you know, are hand selected to create posters for Cirque in sort of the style of the old circus poster. And like Amy Soul here in Las Vegas created yeah. one, and Casey Weldon, formerly of Las Vegas, created one. And so yeah, that show was up and going, and it
they're beautiful. I stopped yeah. by there, and they really are amazing. I wish those mm-hmm. were the posters that they used all the time, because they yeah. were so interesting and exciting, and really sort of channeled the feeling of a Cirque show, which is kind of that mystical,
exactly.
otherworldly type feeling.
That someone sort of kind of raw and, you know, I don't want to say street artist, but lowbrow artist, somebody who hasn't gone so much into the corporate world might grasp that a little
oh, yeah.
bit better. So, yeah, that this was, and there was a lot of diversity.
Sure.
Among the artists.
Very different styles.
Which is why there's another fun show down at 3rd and Imperial at 222 Imperial.
Uh-huh.
It's a fun show that I think his name is Josh Spencer threw together. And it's the same thing. I like shows that have a theme. I like
sure.
group shows, you know, and they have a theme. Like with the Cirque posters, this one has a show of ice cream.
Oh, yeah.
So it's kind of crazy. You know, the art is all over the place. But they
all are about ice cream?
Pretty much, yeah. And
wow.
everyone just sort of ran with it. And, you know, some of it's sexualized. Some of it's sort of the innocence of ice cream on a hot summer day when you're younger. And, yeah, it's I like theme shows.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. I'm a big fan of ice cream, especially at this time of year. I kind of want some right now that we're talking about it.
Well, go down there. You'll get a bomb pop. I got one when
oh,
I was in there.
Yeah. Even better. That's awesome. Yeah. Ice cream and art.
Yeah, and, of course, you want to see Blackbird Studios and Brent Holmes has his Barfing Rainbows over there.
Yes, Barfing Rainbows. That's by Las Vegas Magazine designer Brent Holmes, who mm-hmm. we work with every day. He doesn't normally barf rainbows in the office, but he is doing a show right now down at Blackbird.
And he broke out, yeah, and sort of did something fun. But yeah, usually the Peace and Arts Studio on the second floor of the Arts Factory is open. There, it's just, you know, everybody has different hours, but if you just sort of check it out beforehand and find out who's going to be open, you know, you might want to see everything that's up.
Sure. And for people who've never been down to the Arts Factory or the Arts District at all, I'm always surprised when I talk to people who've lived in Las Vegas for years and years and years, and they've never been to the Arts District.
Mm-hmm.
They've never attended a First Friday, and they almost sound intimidated by it, that, you know, because they haven't been yet and they don't know what the deal is, they'll get lost and won't really understand what's going on or won't be able to find their way. What kind of, I know you are down there all the time. You're a
yeah.
big scene insider. What sort of simple advice would you give to people on just accessing the Arts District?
Well, it depends on where you go. If it's a Friday night, First Friday, there's going to be some parking, but you'll see people all over. But if you're there in the day, I mean, and you're going to the Arts Factory, there's parking right behind the Arts Factory. And across from Arts Factory is Artifice, which is this great new bar by Brett
right.
Sperry, who owns Brett Wesley. And that's a fun place also. And that has a parking lot. And I laugh when I hear the intimidation just because it's such a usual route for me. But I guess because it's a destination and not a walkthrough place so much, people are nervous. But yeah, if you just go to Charleston and Maine and navigate your way so you're behind the Arts Factory or park alongside Brett Wesley's gallery on Casino Center Drive, you can just get out and walk around.
Yeah, I think that's the best advice right mm-hmm. there is just find a place to park right in the middle of things and
mm-hmm.
get out and take a stroll. Spend a little time just walking around and you'll be surprised by the things you come upon.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Well, thank you so much for joining me, Kristen. It was great talking to you.
Thank you.
And you can read more about the August 1st Friday in this week's issue of Las Vegas Weekly. Thank you, our guests this evening, and to our producers here at KUNV. This is Las Vegas Weekly's Radio Mag.